Does it work at all? Yes, it does. Somewhat. So, we are here to celebrate PF's 10th birthday with you. Thanks for sharing. Whenever you have questions, please just raise an arm or indicate or something. If you want to have prolonged discussions, we should move this to the bar tonight because we have 80-something slides to fit. So, in the dark age, before OpenBSD and before PF, the doors were wide open. Security was very, very poor. Everybody went in and out wherever he wants. In 1993, eventually, the computer is invented in Soviet Unterzirkelsdorf, which is surrounded by Austria, by Nikita Khrushchev. There were heavy protests from Georg Paul Thumann, but it didn't matter anyway. They couldn't run this for long because they were short of coal all the time anyway. So in 1995, OpenBSD was born by some guy called Theo. And 2 years later, said Georg Paul Thumann gave up his resistance against computers and forked NetBSD off. In the meantime, OpenBSD gained some reputation, especially as a secure firewall operating system. The firewall package was called IPF, was written by an Australian guy called Darren Reed. Poor Puffy was upside down. It had some limitations and shortcomings and technical issues. We successfully forgot most of them. It's been 10 years, right? So in 2001, Darren clarifies his license. He made clear that shipping of modified versions is not allowed, and OpenBSD, of course, always shipped a modified version because the original was. And, it looked like he tried to make IPF his cash cow, and the only natural solution to that is, delete it, which is what we did on May 30. Followed by this, we did a license audit because we didn't want this to happen again, right? We audited the entire tree and actually found a fair number of license issues.
Like 200, right?
Hundreds. I don't have the number at hand, but it was hundreds, yes. We resolved most by tracking down the original authors and talk to them and getting permissions to distribute under a BSD license. The ones where we couldn't track down the authors or they were assholes or whatever, those were solved by rewriting the piece of software in question, and a few of them were just deleted because they were obsolete anyways. So now, OpenBSD, the firewall OS, was there without a packet filter. There were so many people who had so much to say on the topic. There was the Swiss guy, Daniel Hartmeier, who just didn't have all that much to say. He just sat down and coded. And he had an early prototype quickly, which was committed to the OpenBSD tree on June 24th, which is not even a month after IPF's deletion. And many of the other OpenBSD developers quickly jumped in. In the first few months or weeks, there was like 50 people committing to PF, right? So this was not a one or two person effort. And we quickly had a working firewall package again. The 3.0 release in December the same year was the first one which had PF. Back then, it was mostly an IPF clone, except that we, even before shipping the first version, killed the separate config file for NAT. Most design choices we inherited from IPF, which later turned out to be a problem, we do things different these days. At that time, I was running the previous OpenBSD version with IPF at work, and I actually had a problem with that. The machines peaked at 100% CPU time at the high time. And of course, we had some packet loss, right, if the CPU is packed. And this was on decent hardware, so throwing hardware at the problem was not an option. So, of course, I tried the shiny new PF. Well, this was great for a few seconds, then it crashed. This was followed by a very long debugging session with Daniel. And we eventually found the bug. And by then, the very same hardware that was packed before was peaking at 10% CPU load, which was kind of impressive. And of course, no more packet loss. Half a year later, next release, PF Major, there's gazillions of small commits that are not worth mentioning here. New software, Matrix, right? We improved the fragment handling a lot, which sucked before. We worked on the documentation. We added the interface to address translation so that you can use an interface name wherever you put an address. And we introduced the state limits, which turned out to be very useful later. And at the same year, we had the first ever really big general OpenBSD hackathon. This is basically where every developer shows up. Like every, not all of them, like half of them actually, but still the biggest we have, which is where I joined the project and Ryan followed half a year later, a bit less than that. Next release, half a year later in November.
We were actually both developing on PF before we became OpenBSD developers. Like I did the IPv6 support for 3.0 before 3.0 was released.
And refused the account offer the first time.
Yeah, that was way too scary. I got this offer. Do you want to fix your own bugs in the code, or do you want us to keep committing these patches for you? And I was like, I don't want the responsibility. I might get yelled at by Theo. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
It took them a year to convince me that they basically said, we're not going to commit stuff for you anymore. You have to do it yourself.
Everyone else has been yelled at.
For me, it took Theo only a week to convince me. Same thing. I didn't think I was worth it. I couldn't contribute anything worthwhile. Nick keeps reminding me of that. I mentioned this. He has a copy of this. I don't think I have anything worthwhile to contribute. I was wrong, I think. You judge. Anyway, next release. Again, we have many, many little fixes that are not worth mentioning here. As said, new software. We started what turned out to be one of our major topics over PF's entire lifetime, simplify the language and make it more flexible. We saw anti-spoof, which I think is the first bigger thing I did. And we had the dynamic interface expansion, where the kernel translates the interface name to the IP addresses instead of pfkernel at load time. It does it dynamically. So if you're sitting behind DSL and have your IP address changing every 24 hours, that's kind of useful. Of course, you don't have to reload your rule set every time an IP address changes, right? Half a year later, the language simplification, of course, went on. We got support for Windows scaling. Windows scaling didn't matter that much at that time because nobody was really doing it, and the few systems that had it didn't turn it on by default, right? So we were fine without before. We also got full CIDR support. We kind of had it before, but there were some corner cases and everything got fixed. That was a lot of work. We had a performance boost on rule-set reload. We have the skip steps that on rule-set evaluation. It's basically a pointer. If this rule doesn't match because of the interface not matching, the next 20 rules who match on the same interface cannot match either. So there's a pointer to the 21st rule, which is the first one that matches on a different interface. These skip steps have to be calculated, and Daniel rewrote the algorithm doing that, speeding things up dramatically. We did the early checksum verification in a bad way, but I fixed this a couple of years later. This was triggered by some idiots who believe in stealth invisible firewalls, and they found a way to prove that there's an invisible bridge in between. Whatever. Don't get me started on that again. And at the same release, we saw the first incarnation of SpamD by Bob Beck. And we saw tables. Cedric showed up, wrote the table code. Tables are Redis trees of addresses. They are very fast to look up, and they are routing table semantics, so longest match wins. It's way faster in many addresses than having one rule per address. I still think we screwed this up. We should have fixed the code before getting it. Anyway, ongoing joke here. Ryan introduced the address pools, which are primarily used as redirection targets. So you redirect not to a single host, but to a list of addresses. This is the birth of OpenBSD as load balancer, right? This is the foundation for all the load balancing work, the stuff that we have today. Same release. You notice this is a release that saw a lot of pfwork. Same release, we got anchors, which are the sub-rule sets that you can load independently, implemented by Daniel. Back then, it was a single layer. These days, we have the file system semantics where you can have anchors inside anchors inside anchors, right? This was just a single layer back then. And, well, yeah, a set. You can change the rules inside the anchor independently from the main root set.
So that change was important because it allowed a lot of the other daemons to make changes into the rule set without affecting your main rule set. So you get FTP proxy.
Oh, back then it didn't use anchors.
Yeah, but it was very hard to manage.
Oh,
OthPF used anchors.
Yes, OthPF was the first one, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. When did OthPF show up? Probably that release too, right?
I'm not sure. You have it in the slides?
No. Oh. I don't think so.
It's not part of PF specific.
Exactly. It must be that release. Alt-Q was merged into PF in this release. This was done by Kenjiro Cho from Japan and myself. And we basically did not modify the Alt-Q engine. What we did is we removed the awful classifier that Alt-Q had and just used PF to classify the packets. And PF would just attach a tag to the mbuf telling the Alt-Q engines way further down in which queue this packet was supposed to go. And the extension to get rid of all Alt-Q userland visible tools that we have in PF is that PF can also configure and set up the queue. So this is more than just the classifier. It's also the configuration for Alt-Q. Eventually, 3.4 was released in 2003, where we gained stateful scrubbing of TCP connections. We got the adaptive state limits we still have today, done by Daniel. I implemented the tag and tagged keywords, which, for example, can be used to express trust relationships between interfaces or remember that something matched something on the one side of the firewall, and you can match on this on the other side. Mike also added, I was surprised that this was so old. In my memories, this was much newer, the passive OS fingerprinting. PF, by just looking at the packets, can figure out what operating system the packet comes from. So you can redirect all connections from Windows boxes to port 25. You can redirect them to DevNull.
I should add that if you want to see beautiful, amazing C code, you look at Mike's commits. Like if you go to the CVS web and look at the code that he's written, everybody else, they commit stuff to PF, and then there's, you know, a month or two of fixing bugs afterwards, but Mike's code is always like he has this giant new feature, 10 new files, commit, and then there's never any patches to it, and nobody else wants to touch his files because they know they can only make it worse, they can't improve it.
I touched most of his stuff by now, and it didn't get worse. But yeah, there's truth to that. And at the same release, we got the first incarnation of SimProxy, where PF does the throwaway handshake for the usually client and only connects to the backend server once the throwaway handshake is finished. In the same year, we had the first dedicated PF hackathon, actually in Canada, in Seychelles. Small island not an island, it's on the coast, but only reachable by the ferry. As I said, on the west coast, in the woods, it was awesome. We were challenged by the lack of power and internet. Especially the internet was a problem. We had to lay fiber through the woods. We were really concerned about elk and the other animals stepping on our fiber, but we actually saw them out of the window running by, and they were so scared by the orange color, they stepped over it. By far. It's orange, can't be natural. This is inside. So you see it's only laptops and small boxes because down there we didn't have much power. All the big boxes were on the other end of that fiber. Eventually, pretty much, that was directly after that, right? We went from the hackathon directly to Kansai Quest, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Kansai Quest.
Oh, right, it was before. Really? Oh, whatever. The 3.5 release in May, where Ryan implemented source tracking, where you kind of remember something about a particular source host. Back then, it was used to limit the number of connections a certain IP address can make to your servers. Well, works the other way around as well, but this is where it makes most sense. And this was also used for sticky errors in the redirection, when you redirect to a pool to make sure that a particular client always ends up on the same backend host. So you have to remember what backend host that client went to, right? Cedric did the first incarnation of the interface abstraction, which caused us grief later, but anyway. This allows PF to refer to non-existent interfaces, like interfaces that don't exist at rule set load time. Think about hot plug interfaces. So you could have PF refer to it, it would load the rule set, and once the interface shows up, it just works. And there were also interface groups in there, but they were far away from what we have today. It was just groups by driver, so EM0, EM1, and all the other EMs would end up in a group called EM, however useful that is. And Ryan added what we keep referring to as the RDR to localhost protection. Many daemons have a wildcard bind and have a separate bind on localhost to distinguish local connections from remote connections. So if you redirect a remote connection to localhost, you end up on the trusted socket, which is kind of dangerous. So we changed the stack to treat redirected connections from PF as if they are remote and not local, even if you redirect to localhost. Even back then, without any failover capabilities, many people had pairs of firewalls, including myself. You would have one active one and one hot standby and manual failover. And of course, it would be great if this would work automatically, right? And turns out there's even a protocol for it called VRRP. A certain router maker, oh, sorry, they don't really make routers anymore. A certain telephone maker has patent claims on VRRP. We kind of thought they were unfounded, but we're uncertain. So we basically took VRRP and changed the protocol to just around the bits that the patents covered. Changed it just so much that the patent doesn't apply anymore. And at the same time, we made it better by making it address family independent and improving the crypto, the authentication, which of course means that this is not VRRP compatible anymore. But we didn't think this would be a problem, and I think we were right on that. Do you want failover between OpenBSD and a Cisco? That would be interesting, actually. That's live replacement without downtime. Should think about that. Anyway. So, CARP was born. The man page calls it Common Address Redundancy Protocol. It was actually called Cisco ASA Redundancy Protocol, but we're not supposed to say this in public. This was written by Ryan based on an earlier VRRP implementation that Mickey did, but that we never committed because of those patent claims. For this protocol, you need a multicast address. So we went to IANA and requested one, and IANA said, well, no, you don't get one. There's VRRP. You're implementing the same thing, so you don't get a multicast address. So what should we do? We keep using the VRRP one, right? So CARP, first header fields are still the same between VRRP and CARP. So there's a version number field, and CARP just announces itself as VRRP version 3. Your real VRRP is at version 2. That was funny because some buggy Cisco routers crashed when they saw these packets. Not our bug. Not our bug. I mean, anybody can make such a packet, right? So it's a bug no matter what, and not our problem. But it was funny. Alongside the failover, we always, of course, wanted pfsync to sync the state tables of the two so that established connections don't break. And once we had that, with CARP and pfsync, you have a redundant OpenBSD firewall cluster without a hacked bolt-on solution, like a userland utility that pings the other and takes interfaces up and down and hopes that the switches run the back addresses quickly enough. Is it obvious what I'm referring to? I don't say Linux now. Okay, it doesn't have a $50,000 price tag either. That's Cisco. That only gives you failover. Fail back is another 50K. Awesome.
That's
checkpoint?
Oh,
that was checkpoints. Sorry. It's not just Cisco. And history continues. We asked for a protocol number for pfsync 2. And, well, Ayana was like, oh, you're using that multicast address without asking us, so we're not giving you a protocol number. Okay. We picked an unused one. These days in the list of protocol numbers, there's that number is classified as reserved. Oh, well. Well, what should we do? I mean, we asked nicely, what should we do? So they were upset. There was this famous email exchange. They were upset. They told us, you cannot do this. It's forbidden, and you must not ship this code. So who's Ayana? Who made them God? Who are they to tell us what we send out on our Ethernet cables? Like, we talked to them for a bit, so just give us numbers and be done with it. And they denied, like, no, you can implement VRRP, but there's patent claims, so we don't care. Eventually, we decided to ignore them. They kept venting for a while, and then, well, it was over. They could just have given us...
If you have enough money and you're a three-letter agency, it's no problem to get a number assigned. One of those, but if you don't have one of those, if you're not a big vendor, it's really hard to
do this stuff. They could have avoided this by just giving us numbers, right? Even afterwards, but whatever, not our problem. So, Carbon pfsync being a big achievement, of course, made the release team. And the first batch of the CDs for that just arrived in time for the CANSEC West conference in Vancouver. And, of course, we sold them there. And it turned out that one of the first CD sets was bought by a Cisco employee. The entire release team was making fun of Cisco. He didn't get it. After that, real life interrupts sometimes, I had a big distributed denial of service attack, basically a really big SYN flood at work, that got my firewall so busy that I couldn't even log in on the console anymore to analyze and fix the problem, right? So we worked hard to reproduce the problem. That was Bob and I mostly, and managed. And we added the congestion handling, which is pretty cool, actually. To detect overload, we look at the input queue, the IP input queue, and the IPv6 input queue if you run that shit. And whenever that queue is full, it's absolutely clear you're short on CPU power to process it, right? So we set a flag. And as long as that flag is set, PF will not do any rule set evaluation, but only state table evaluation. So connections that are already established would just work, would just continue to work, but new ones would be blocked. So we are still dropping packets, just like we did before. We just do it much more selectively. In testing this, we had a console connection to the device and had sysdet running to look at the system. And it behaved pretty well. And afterwards, we noticed, oh, wait a minute. This is not a console connection. This was SSH'd in. So it worked really well. Next release, November 3.6. Daniel rewrote anchors. We only rewrote this twice, right? Yeah. Getting us the layered system we have now, the file system-like semantics. Biggest user, I think it's FTP proxy, was the first one, probably still is the biggest. And Mike wrote us the rule set optimizer, which is awesome. And at the same year, there was this infamous ferry ride. The two of us were on the way to a hike on the West Coast near Emma Lake. We are going to do this again in a few weeks. Awesome. To get there, you have to catch a ferry, then cross over the land there, get the next ferry, cross over, get the next ferry. That takes a while. So we were sitting on that ferry, up there in the front somewhere, I think, talking about what would we do different if we started PF from scratch. Some of the things we came up, we clearly could not implement without screwing our entire user base. But there was enough things that we could change in the existing PF. We didn't write it down, but we kept it in mind. Once we were up at Emalek, that's Emalek. Once we were up there, we had the design for the new PF. It was clear that we had to re-implement the state table. We had an idea how. It was clear that we had to kill the separate translation, like NET and RER and that stuff, rule set, and the separate normalization rule set, that's scrub. Instead, we would just make those actions on regular rules, except for one particular thing in scrub, which is fragment reassembly, which obviously has to happen before we do rule set evaluation. And we also had a vague idea on the match rules that we got much later. It was also clear that interface abstraction and groups must be rewritten, and I cannot repeat what we had to say about Route 2 and the table code, sorry. It was also clear that this was a monster task. There was lots of preparational work to do. I mean, there's lots of redesign and rework that happens behind the scenes without anything being user visible, just preparation, right? And this is not satisfying. You work your ass off and it's invisible. We estimated this would be 2, maybe 3 years. Well, we're pretty much done now, 6 years later. Despite all those plans, we made another release, 3.7, which came with the most prominent paid feature we ever had on PF. I also think it's the only bigger feature that was directly paid. It's max source con rate. We didn't do this because they paid. We did this because they showed up, had this problem, and had this idea on how to solve this. And we were like, yeah, that's an awesome idea. We would probably have implemented this anyway. That company taking money and giving it to us just accelerated this. It was a response to a really bad distributed denial of service attack. And Daniel wrote the connection rate algorithm, where we figured out what the connection rate actually is. And based on that, Ryan implemented the max source con rate and friends, again, using the source tracking nodes. Everybody knows what the feature does, right? Any host that opens too many connections in a too short time gets added to a table that you can block them. Same release, that's work I did, route labels. You basically have 32 bytes of random data that you can attach to a route. This is typically done by a routing daemon such as BGPD, and PF can then filter based on that route. So for example, you can have PF filter on AS numbers if you make BGP insert the AS numbers with the routes. We also gained set skip, which allows you to turn PF off on a per interface basis. It's good for performance. In the same year, Georg Paul Thoman died. You should Google him. He's an awesome guy. OpenBSD 3.8 was released in November, where I rewrote the interface abstraction and interface grouping stuff to what we have today. So the grouping happens with IF config and not inside PF. And the abstraction code is readable. And we got a few automatic groups. Our ever favorite is egress. The egress group just follows the default route. So all interfaces that have a default, you can have multiple default routes, right? So all interfaces that have a default route pointing to them are in an egress group. So example, laptop, wired and wireless, if you just make your rootset work on egress instead of on EM0 and whatever shitty Intel wireless is in there, it doesn't matter whether you're wired or wireless, it'll just cope. There's also an automatic group for all WAVLAN and for all clonables like PPPoE or PPP. So PPPoE 0 and 1 and 2 end up in the PPPoE group. This is especially useful for PPP-like stuff. In 2006, we released 3.9. After the flurry of changes before, we had mostly bug fixes and maintenance. We gained the new FTP proxy. Was it the second or the third? Probably the third.
I think that's the second one.
The second? Third was later? Well, whatever. And we got a TFTP proxy, very important. 4.0, same year. I implemented the multiple routing tables. The intent was to kill Route 2. This did not work out, unfortunately. Part of the ferry concept, right? But based on that, Claudio mostly implemented R domains, which gives you virtual routers on OpenBSD. Like, you can have the same IP address on different interfaces and different R domains on the same machine. And Damien implemented URPF. What does Uni... Unicast reverse, what was it?
Path
filtering, right. Who came up with that word?
A company
called, yes. Starting with C. Yes, surprise. 4.1, much to our surprise, didn't really have any PF work, well, nothing user visible. Well, maybe except for main page changes. In 4.2, the IPv6 routing header 0 issue became public, and we changed PF to treat...
I believe the 4.1 is where FreeBSD is now. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's about right, I think.
So anything after this is not available in FreeBSD yet?
Yep. So we changed PF to treat these routing headers just like IPv4 packets with a source routing option set. Drop them. And that release, I doubled PF performance, literally. Instead of using mbuff tags for the queue information and the tag thingies and everything else, we stuff that information directly into the packet header mbuff, so we don't have to malloc any memory, which turned out to be the bottleneck in that case. Don't do this in your own software. Malloc is better than anything you can write your own. This is a very special case. Anyway, the little circuits we had there for testing went from 29 to 58 megabits a second. Kind of impressive. It also suffered from mutations in the network interface card driver. By the end of that hackathon, it did line rate because those were fixed too. And there were a couple of more performance improvements, but I outlined them in a previous talk, so I'm not going to do it again. There's one thing that we just found out about. For the reasons of code beauty, I folded pf underscore test underscore TCP and UDP and ICMP and other into one big PF test. And as said, this was done for code beauty. Ways later, this year, when Ryan ran his benchmarks, we found out that this helped performance considerably. And we actually started, after we did all the preparation work that was invisible, we actually started on implementing the new state table, the ferry concept. As usual, OpenBSD in an evolutionary, not revolutionary way, Ryan split the state keys of the state so that multiple states can get chained on a single state. We could not have conflicting states before. And you can have conflicting states if you have interface-bound states and floating ones, or interface-bound states on different interfaces. And I re-implemented the interface-bound states on that because we had separate state tables for that before and had to do lookups in that state table, and then the global one, which, of course, is not good for performance. Implementation details we don't have time for. And in OpenBSD 4.3, same year, next year, 2008, was mostly maintenance. PFGriddle grew include support, so you can just include another config file.
I think the PF that's in Mac OS is based on
4.3. No. That's 4.12.
What they have in their source revision control is 4.3. I don't know what they're
shipping. Really? They are ahead of FreeBSD now. Awesome. The next version of Mac OS X ships with PF instead of IPFW. In the same year, we had the network hackathon in Tokyo and a small earthquake. And this was the birth of the new PF state table. Designing this took a while. This whiteboard is 3 hours of work. And of course, it has a clown. There, a cloud. Where's the clown? There's the clown. It's hiding. And DLG saved us 8 bytes in the state table. This is important. Anyway, so without NAT, this is the new state table thing. This is actually intermediate. This is the state key that has all the information that you need to match a state, the addresses, the ports, the address family, the protocol, as in TCP, UDP, and the head of a list of actual states, which has state items, which in turn point to states, and the states point back to state keys. And you notice that a state has two pointers back to the state key. Because in the case of NAT, the pointers back are different state keys because the addresses change, right, with NAT. At least one of them changes. And those state keys can even be linked to each other, which means that if we found the state on the inbound interface and we have states linked, we don't have to do any state lookup on the outbound side for a forward connection. We just follow the pointer. Dirt cheap, help performance considerably. Yes, this was hard work. And this is the hike afterwards we did in Japan. And in November, we eventually released 4.4 OpenBSD, 4.4, state key linking, unfortunately, had to be disabled just before we wrote the release because there were last-minute bugs. I mean, I wrote this, and I'm not Mike. Marcus did the first incarnation of Divert for easier and faster userland proxies, and I implemented the sloppy session tracker. We have this awesome TCP session tracking algorithm, right, that looks at all the flags and everything and verifies toughly that this is actually the connection that belongs to that state. And for asynchronous routing, where you don't see the window size advertisements, this is the biggest issue in that, the window size, you just plain don't see half of the packets, right? So you don't see the window size advertisement for one site. And so it's not only pointless, it actually hurts that the tracker verifies that the sequence number is right inside the window. So for those, and only for those situations, we added the sloppy tracker. It took us a while to come up with the keyword to make clear that users should not use this unless they exactly know what they're doing. I did a few attempts to gain performance using the sloppy tracker instead of the full-blown one. It's not a single bit faster than the full one, even though the full one does a lot of more work. With the sloppy one, you just spend more time waiting for the caches to catch up. I didn't do it for RelayD. It was at the general hackathon afterwards, and I did it for asynchronous routing, and Reich then picked it up for RelayD.
Okay.
But I did not have RelayD in mind when I did this.
Sure.
But yeah, it's very useful for RelayD too,
server
return.
The only case that I know that people should use it.
Well, asynchronous routing in general. Anyway, next release, I found and squashed the state key linking bugs and added a little safety checker thingy so we could ship with that on. And DLG once more rewrote pfsync. This is not the last time this was rewritten. We also got pflow, which is NetFlow version 5 export from pf. Basically, the state is what Cisco calls a flow, right? So, and this is what NetFlow is about. So when the state is torn down, we take the statistics from the state and send the NetFlow packet out to the collector. There's pflow interfaces. Pflow interfaces, awesome. That are used to configure the collector's IP and port number. And, of course, you can have multiple interfaces, meaning that you send the pflow shit to multiple collectors. 4.6 released in the same year was the release where we enabled pf by default. So anybody who installs OpenBSD now has pf enabled. DLG not rewrote but improved pf sync again, changed it a lot. Claudio got the basics of the outer mains ready, and Ryan basically rewrote the ICMP tracking code because we had, let's call it, shortcomings. It's awesome now. Again, this is from the Ferry concept. I killed the separate rule set for Scrub. Scrub mixed two things that should not have been mixed in the first place. It mixed packet reassembly and rewriting certain fields. Packet reassembly has to happen stateless, because to match a state, you have to reassemble, right? And so reassembly, we turned into a simple on-off button and at the same time made it on by default. Anybody who did not have a scrub rule in his pf.conf at that time simply forgot it. Like, it was never on purpose. Splitting this off meant that we could do all the other things that scrub did. We could do them stateful, thus much faster. And so scrub just became an action on regular routes. And to avoid repeating those scrub statements, like the MSS clamping that you have behind DSL routes, since you don't want to repeat that on every pass rule, it was clear that we need what we later called match rules. So in PF, there used to be the notion that there's exactly one last matching rule, and that decides on everything. So we had the state, it's the key, whatever, just point back to the rule, and the rule had all the actions on it, right? in a world where intermediate rules matching change certain fields, this doesn't work out. So we had to move lots of stuff into the state that used to be in the rules before. We didn't, especially I implementing this, did not realize what a substantial change this is. I knew it was big, but that it was that substantial only showed up later, because now we don't have a single rule deciding on everything, but intermediate changes, right? So for match rules, we apply actions on the fly. The list of actions that we have is here. Well, there's a bit more, but that's the basics. And the match rules never changed the block or pass state. So if there was a pass rule before that matched, the packets would still be passed after it matched those match rules. 2010, again, we had an Africa hackathon in Australia. This is actually a picture from the hike afterwards in Tasmania, which was awesome. Gotta go back there. Holy crap. And a bit later, I'll come back to what we implemented there, because this is after that release. 4.7 was released, where we did divert for real, so now the proxies actually use it. And my net rewrite hit the tree. So one IP address per computer doesn't always cut it, right? So we need NAT. And what we had sucked. So I committed my NAT rework, which I wrote way earlier at a hackathon in Basel. But since we had so many other PF changes in already, you don't want to stack changes on changes and changes on changes, then shortly before release notice that the lowest one has a bug and you have to pull it, right? That sucks. So it had to wait until after the release. And I had to maintain those 4,000 lines of diff outside the tree. That was painful. What it did is it removed the NAT and RDR and binet rules and introduced NAT2 and RDR2 actions on regular rules. Binet I didn't care about. It was later added back by pfkiddle emulating binet by making the proper NAT and RDR2 combination rules. So with that, we didn't have multiple rule sets anymore. There's only filter rules now. No more translation, no more normalization. That's it, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Which means that we could get rid of a lot of code dealing with the multiple rule set thingies, different types of rule sets. I broke sticky errors on the way, but this was noticed a bit later, and I had to re-implement this at the next hackathon that I don't have a picture from. So OpenBSD 4.8 was released in 2010 without major PF changes, because we really had to recover from this. And 4.9, and this is actually work I started in Australia and finished in Japan, I rewrote most of the logging subsystem, like as in PF log, mostly for performance, but also to gain more features. So you can now log on the fly as we traverse the rule set. And the logged packet is exactly what PF sees at that very same moment. You also can log a single packet more than once now. And there's a really neat thing to trace how PF matches packets. Like if you have an early match rule that you put your criteria, like from your test host, to turn the tracing on for just these packets. What else did I want to mention about this? Oh, we also now, and this is awesome, include the original IP addresses and port numbers before any NAT or RDR was done in the PF log packet. So if you look at the logs, you get the rewritten addresses as well as the original ones. You see both. And now it's Ryan's turn.
So I was dubious about Henning's claims. He makes often, he'll in his talks before, you'll see his claims. This feature increased performance by 50%, and then...
And I always measured it.
Yeah. But the performance numbers don't add up. It's not like every time you double the performance, it actually doubles the whole performance, because all those individual changes are different subsystems, and often those subsystems have very complicated dependencies. So you can't just extrapolate the performance of the system based on some of the changes. So I have numbers. I did a bunch of testing. This is not based on testing. This is just an illustration of kind of the complexity of PF and why perhaps some of the other projects haven't moved beyond this point. Because obviously there was this very initial early development when we're adding features, we're adding a lot of code and new files as some of the bigger features go in, they have separate files. And then we plateaued in terms of files and in terms of files outside of PF, which include the pfvar.h file, which is all the function definitions and structures that use PF. So this is kind of a metric of tentacles in the rest of the OS. So once we get to this point when we started rewriting the state table with the ferry concept, you start having pieces of PF code in the routing code, in the TCP and UDP PCB handlers. What other stuff in the kernel? The bridge code. There's a lot. As we add some of these performance optimizations, you're getting more and more integration with other parts of the kernel. And I think this is maybe part of what's scary to other projects who are thinking about moving forward with the newer PF. But it's not really that bad. I mean, the code has been written with this situation in mind, and we don't actually depend on all of those tentacles for the functionality of PF.
If it's not there, we just fall back to the old code.
Yeah, the old cases are all there, because even in our code, we can't always rely on there being a pointer to a state. You might have the pointer to a state there, but it might be the first packet of a connection, or it might be a connection that you've lost. You still have to handle that condition.
Or you might run an OpenBSD machine without PF, but this is blasphemia.
So it is possible to move ahead with the current version of PF. You just can't get all of those hooks without doing some of this integration into the rest of the code. So I did performance testing, like I said. A lot of the performance testing is ad hoc. You know, the developer just does a test with the boxes that he has at hand.
It's micro benchmarks, because you bench the feature you're working on and not the entire thing, right?
Not really automated, not really well reported. People don't tell you exactly what the situation, what configuration, what hardware they were using. We get test results from the users often on the mailing list, and they tend to test the wrong thing. Like, they'll test megabits per second when it doesn't really tell you much about the performance of the packet filter. With a packet filter, you're usually interested in packets per second. But we typically don't get those numbers from users. They're starting to get better at it now, I think. Yep. About half the users will give us packets per second numbers now. Also, generating high load on you know, the test hardware that you have lying around. Most of the OpenBSD developers, there's a very few number of developers that work for companies that do network hardware, and they have access to a real load generator, real packet testers. But most of us, it's just, you know, things that are lying around, and it's hard to do this. So a lot of the test results that you see from developers, and a lot of the stuff that Henning has quoted, have been like Pentium M board, like a little embedded type board with the CPU clocked really low so that he can overload the system from his laptop. So those are, I mean, it gives you a comparison before and after with a feature, but it's not necessarily matching the performance improvement you're going to get on a Xeon, for example. So for the performance testing that I did, I didn't use any special load generation hardware. I don't have any. I don't have the money for it. And I like to know exactly what's going on when I send a packet. So we have this tiny little program written using libdnet that just generates random SYN packets. And I wrote a driver, a diff for EM, that basically recycles packets within the EM driver, just changes the IP address within the interrupt handler and sends them out again. so I could get much better sand performance. I have a bunch of Dell boxes lying around that I can use for this. And I was before the EM driver change, I could get like maybe 25,000 packets per second out of an EM card with the system, and the system would be pegged. And with this driver, I can get about 450,000 packets per second.
We will never release this. It's too easy to kill the internet.
So with three or four of those Dell boxes, I can completely load a gigabit Ethernet with like SYN packets. So that gives you a real denial of service attack kind of measurement. So, and because I wanted to do testing against every release to give us a time series, there's a lot of tests. The tests take a long time to run. So I set my infrastructure up so I could run tests in parallel with locking on the load generation boxes, so that if I'm only generating a small amount of load, I could be running four tests against different targets. And when I need the full gigabit, I would point all of my targets at the one box. And this is all automated. I looked in the test series that I used to generate the charts that you're going to see. I ran 30,000 tests, independent tests. It's hard to measure the performance. There's a bunch of the features inside the kernel that alter the performance data as you're going under load, and there's a lot of not features, like when you're really under load, you might miss clock interrupts or something like that, so you don't really get valid numbers out of the targets. The other problem I had is I'm testing back to OpenBSD 3.0, so a lot of the tools have changed a little bit, or metrics that are available now were not available before in the earlier releases, so I really didn't want to depend on tools that are installed on the target. And the last thing is, I've done a little bit of testing against other OSs, but I'd like to do another talk later with more comparison against, you know, FreeBSD, NetBSD, Linux, maybe some commercial firewall, hardware firewalls. And if I depend on the tools that are built into OpenBSD, it's hard for me to do that measurement. So the numbers I have here are from measurements taken on the switches. I put managed switches on either side of the targets and took the numbers from there. I did take numbers from a bunch of other places in the test setup just to cross-check, to validate that the numbers that I was seeing are sane coming from the switches. This is just basically the structure of the setup. I'm going to skip through. I don't want to describe everything here, but I'm trying to do a better job of documenting what's being done in the testing in case somebody wants to repeat this. And I will the scripts that I'm using are really ugly, but I would like to maybe, it's written like shell and awk and whatever tool fit the bill at the time, but I would like to rewrite it all in Perl and make it usable so that other people can do the testing as well. So this is a measurement of rule set evaluation performance. So I wrote rules, some rule sets that are worst case rule sets, so that a packet that comes in is evaluated against every rule in the rule set. And this particular chart is a rule set with about 1,000 rules in it. So this is kind of the worst, really worst case. And PF has all these optimizations that will skip rules if they don't apply to the packet. So in the real world, you would get much better performance than this with the rule set with 1,000 rules. All this test data I didn't mention in the slide is, this is all against a Socris 4801, which is not really a powerful firewall, but it's easy to load it and get to see what happens when it's loaded. It's also a box that there's a lot of those boxes around. It's a standardized platform that everybody, like if you say I have this model of Socris, everybody really knows what box is.
Yeah,
and it's also hard to find hardware that runs every release of OpenBSD. I wanted to run a test series on like something more modern, like an HP server, like a DL360 G5 that I have, or a G7 that I have, but we don't have the SCSI drivers for the RAID controller in those boxes for going back to 3.0.
Well, of course, that was much older than the actual hardware.
So basically here, this is where your firewall has failed. And the differences between after that is just kind of how gracefully does it fail. But you're probably wanting to pick your hardware so that you can handle your maximum load without getting to this point. This chart, it looks like a mess, but you can break it out into about four different groups. So this is the early years. When you can see here, as the releases come out, we're adding more tests. Initially, we're just testing for IP addresses and ports. We're adding tests for the users, for the OS fingerprinting. All these additional tests in the PF rule set test routine are being added. So it's just more if statements. It takes more time to evaluate. So the performance drops as we add the features. You get a plateau, and then as the system basically can't handle the interrupt load that it's receiving anymore, your performance collapses. This is the second grouping. This is after the congestion handling went in that starts, it skips rule set evaluation once the machine is hammered. So you gain some interactive performance on the box against dropping packets.
Also, it prefers established connections, and this is testing the non-established connections.
Yeah,
this is what we want to hurt in that case.
So it looks bad, but it's actually you're not really forwarding any more traffic past the failure point, anyways, and the box is more responsive.
Actually, in that case, we are still forwarding the established ones. This is punishing the new ones on purpose.
Like yes.
The new ones
yeah.
Here. So this should go down. It's good.
We in 4.2 we increased the max length on the IFQ. So there's more packets being queued from the interfaces before it gets into PF, and the PF congestion handling is triggered based on that queue being full. So if the queue is bigger, obviously the congestion handling gets triggered later. So it basically just changes the slope of that curve. And then in 4.6, we got MCLGetEye, which is an interface for managing MBUF clusters, but it also responds to congestion when there are lost interrupts. It will scale back the buffer size of a network card. So in that case, instead of having PF doing the packet dropping much later, and you've all done all this work, you've done all the early handling, all the ether input, all this work up to half of IP input, and then you're going to drop it, you can just let the network card drop it early. And so you're not going to waste all those cycles. So you're back to having this plateau here. And then in the long term, the box doesn't completely die. So we're still working at that. But if you look by the release numbers, this feature is improving every release, our stability over, as you get into the extremely high loads, is improving. So, I mean, the ideal situation is you would have a slope up here, and then you would have just a straight line straight across. That's kind of the ideal. I mean, that's what we're targeting. There's still some area in here where you're switching in and out of live lock, and so the feature is kicking in and kicking out, and so you're getting a lot more varied performance at that point. All that is kind of messy. So this is basically just a measurement of what's the maximum throughput on the firewall, basically. The point at which it starts dropping packets.
Stateless.
Yeah. This trough here, this is where the PF congestion handling went in. So you lose a little bit of your maximum performance.
Well, stateless.
Stateless.
Again, this is important because it prefers the states over the new ones, right?
Yeah. This is the stateful filtering performance.
There we go. This is what's relevant for the real world.
So this is a little bit tricky because you can't, this improvement here, this jump, doesn't appear to come from the PF changes. This is probably, and we maybe have to go back and do like bisection of all of some of the features that were done in here and do more detailed testing.
No. This is the MBOF tags.
This is, there's a bunch of things. No.
It's not just that, but that's about half of it.
There's MBOF tags. The IFQ length was changed in this release. We also did the random number pool stirring was changed in this release. So there was a bunch of things that were changed then. And then later, this is where we started making the changes to the PF state table that were talked about. So, and then that brought up the performance to basically match the performance difference that you see down here. So there are complex interactions here, and I guess maybe one of the things that needs to be highlighted is that you can't just take PF and put it in a different operating system with the configuration that's used in OpenBSD. You actually have to look at other components within the OS. I don't know the interrupt handling, the queuing and everything on other platforms is different, so you have to adjust those parameters as well and test the whole system, not just assume that the optimizations that are made in PF for OpenBSD are going to be valid for another platform. Drivers, hardware, especially hardware, makes a huge difference, and it's not always intuitive. For example, I tested EM in Asocris, and the SIS card that's in Asocris is actually better on the Asocris than the EM. EM has lots of nice features for interrupt mitigation, but they're not tuned for Asocris, so it doesn't actually help the Asocris because even with the interrupt mitigation turned on, the Asocris still gets hammered. And the downside of the EM is all these nice features require a lot of code in the driver. So the interrupt handler in EM is much, much heavier than the interrupt handler in on the SIS card that's in the Asocris. So the SIS, the crappy network card in the Asocris was actually well chosen for that class of hardware. So you can't just buy necessarily the most expensive card. You have to actually test it in your situation.
Okay, since we're pretty much over time, quick word on the others. FreeBSD is stuck in early 2007, and you guys should fix this. And if you are responsible for PF in FreeBSD, do better than the previous guys and actually talk to us. We cannot judge your diffs and buy them back if you don't show them to us, right? NetBSD is even worse. Apple, as said, will ship PF in the next OS X. Of course, it's kind of ancient. Yep, your system, not all that well. That's it. We don't really have time for questions, but if there are questions, just ask them because we're over time anyway. Yes?
I'm not sure about the status of SMP on OpenBSD, but
it works fine. It does!
I trust you.
We don't need to. We know the result. It doesn't.
We don't have SMP in the kernel.
Well, not much.
What I did measure, what I found interesting, is that people have been telling users for a long time that you're better off running single processor because we don't have support in the kernel for SMP. And people have been telling, well, you know, there's SMP overhead, so you're better off running a single processor, like single processor kernel, even if your box has more cores, you should only run on one. And I tested that, and that's not true. The performance is the same for us, whether you have SMP or single processor kernel. But we have no performance improvement from it.
No SMP in the kernel sounds a bit worse than it is. It's big lock, except for very few things. So it's mostly big lock.
Because you probably know that NetBSD started a separate firewall project because of the scalability.
No, yeah. Of course they need to make their own. I don't know.
It's not because it's kind of
late. We do have plans to fix this, but...
My question is about the plans.
Yeah.
Because FreeBSD would need to either update PF at some point or adopt NPF or do some other stuff like...
Well, how about that? Update your PF, fix the SMP stuff, and give us the SMP fixes.
Sounds good.
If you go back to your last graph, it was your state. How did you generate that when your generator was a SIN? Well, it's a SIN flood.
Oh, this is using a different tool. Sorry, this is not using the SIN flood. This is using TCP Bench, which is part of OpenBSD. I use the SIN flood tool to load the state table to a certain amount, and then I stopped the SIN flood and did the stateful TCP session testing after that.
I'll give you one first. Yeah, just more of a question here, just some of your observations with the Intel chips versus the SIS. Or is, did you guys find it all that, like in terms, like I don't know if you guys have polling, about, like interface polling or something to compensate or
We auto-size the receive rings. That fixes those problems. We don't need polling.
Okay, so you don't. So with your testing, like I guess where I was going was just more for in terms of live lock. Like what if anything you guys were experiencing just from interrupts constantly firing?
There's only so far you can get with that. We're probably going to make changes because the feeling is there's actually too much queuing still happening. That the kernel is still doing too much work on packets that will have to be dropped anyways. So right now we push down the size of the receive ring on the interface, so that helps, but we still empty it on every interrupt. So every interrupt, the interface, even if like on an EM it can go down to 4. But 4 packets, like 8,000 times a second, is too much for a SOCRIS. The SOCRIS can only handle, depending on the size of your rule set, it might only be like 500 packets a second or 200 packets a second. So that mechanism only goes so far. So we have to start not draining the ring on the interface to let the interface drop even more packets. And that's there need to be some structural changes higher up in the stack to allow that, to push information down to the drivers that the queues up above are actually, full. So don't empty it down here.
Also, we have all this awesome infrastructure is in the RX path, but we still have problems with the TX path actually overloading us in these situations. So there's more work to be done. What we have is awesome. It's probably impossible to get the box completely live-locked now. This is awesome. But we're not completely done yet. It can still get even better. And, of course, we're working on that. More questions?
You had a question?
Yeah.
You forgotten? Okay.
That's it? Nobody brought us beer?
I was waiting for you to pull it out of your bag
last
year.
I did it last year.
I know.
And they told me it's illegal on university premises. I drank it any... Oh, sorry. I didn't drink it, of course.
I turned off the mic. You can admit to things now.
I hope we are late in the work in progress talk, because otherwise we just missed our own talk. I just ran it off the stick.
Yeah.
Or, well, maybe I copy it.
Yeah.